off. Or not on that night. She'd bribed her Martha to back up the murderous handmaid story, combining the bribe with threats. Then she'd called the angels and accused the handmaid, and the rest had followed. The unfortunate girl was found wandering the streets in despair. Since the map was inaccurate, and the Mayday contacts turned out not to exist. The handmaid had been interrogated. The transcript of the interrogation was attached, and it was not comfortable reading. Although admitting to her escape attempt and revealing Paula's part in it, she'd maintained her innocence of the murder, indeed her ignorance of the murder, until the pain had become too much, and she'd made a false confession. She was clearly innocent, but she was hanged anyway. The aunts had known the truth, or at least one of them had known. There was the evidence, right in the folder in front of me. Yet nothing had happened to Paula, and a handmaid had been hanged for the crime instead. I was bedazzled, as if struck by lightning. But not only was I astounded by this story, I was mystified as to the reason it had been placed on my desk. Why had an unknown person given me such dangerous information? Once a story you've regarded as true has turned false, you begin suspecting all stories. Was an effort being made to turn me against Gilead? Was the evidence faked? Was it Aunt Lydia's threat to reveal Paula's crime that had caused my stepmother to abandon her efforts to marry me to Commander Judd? Had this terrible story bought me my place as an aunt at Ardua Hall? Was this a way of telling me that my mother, Tabitha, had not died of a disease but had been murdered in some unknown way by Paula, and possibly even by Commander Kyle? I didn't know what to believe. There was no one I could confide in, not even Becca. I didn't want to endanger her by making her complicit. The truth can cause a lot of trouble for those who are not supposed to know it. I finished my work for the day, leaving the blue folder where I'd found it. The next day, there was a new speech for me to work on, and the blue folder of the day before was gone. Over the course of the following 2 years, I found a number of similar folders waiting for me on my desk. They all held evidence of various crimes. Those containing the crimes of wives were blue, of commanders, black, of professionals, such as doctors, gray, of econo people, striped, of Martha's, dull green. There were none containing the crimes of handmaids, and none for those of aunts. Most of the files left for me were either blue or black and described multiple crimes. Handmaids had been forced into illegal acts, then blamed for them. Sons of Jacob had plotted against one another. Bribes and favors had been exchanged at the highest levels. Wives had schemed against other wives. Martha's had eavesdropped and collected information and then sold it. Mysterious food poisonings had occurred. Babies had changed hands from wife to wife on the basis of scandalous rumors that were, however, unfounded. Wives had been hanged for adulteries that had never occurred because a commander wanted a different, younger wife. Public trials, meant to purge traitors and purify the leadership, had turned on false confessions extracted by torture. Bearing false witness was not the exception. It was common. Beneath its outer show of virtue and purity, Gilead was rotting. Apart from Paula's, the file that most immediately concerned me was that of Commander Judd. It was a thick file. Among other misdemeanors, It contained evidence pertaining to the fates of his previous wives, those he had been married to before my short-lived engagement to him. He had disposed of them all. The first had been pushed down the stairs. Her neck was broken. It was said that she'd tripped and fallen. As I knew from my reading of other files, it was not difficult to make such things look like accidents. Two of his wives were said to have died in childbirth, or shortly thereafter. The babies were unbabies, but the deaths of the wives had involved deliberately induced septicemia or shock. In one case, Commander Judd had refused permission to operate when an unbaby with two heads had lodged in the birth canal. Nothing could be done, he'd said piously, because there had still been a fetal heartbeat. The fourth wife had taken up flower painting as a hobby at the suggestion of Commander Judd, who had thoughtfully purchased the paints for her. She'd then developed symptoms attributable to cadmium poisoning. Cadmium, the file noted, was a well-known carcinogenic, and the fourth wife had succumbed to stomach cancer shortly thereafter. I'd narrowly avoided a death sentence, it seemed. And I'd had help avoiding it. I said a prayer of gratitude that night. Despite my doubts, I continued to pray. Thank you, I said. Help thou my unbelief. I added, and help Shunammite, for she will surely need it. When I'd first begun reading these files, I was appalled and sickened. Was someone trying to cause me distress? Or were the files part of my education? Was my mind being hardened? Was I being prepared for the tasks I would later be performing as an aunt? This was what the aunts did, I was learning. They recorded. They waited. They used their information to achieve goals known only to themselves. Their weapons were powerful but contaminating secrets, as the Marthas had always said. Secrets, lies, cunning, deceit. But the secrets, the lies, the cunning, and the deceit of others, as well as their own. If I remained at Ardua Hall, if I performed my Pearl Girls missionary work and returned as a full aunt, this is what I would become. All of the secrets I had learned, and doubtless many more, would be mine, to use as I saw fit. All of this power, all of this potential to judge the wicked in silence, and to punish them in ways they would not be able to anticipate. All of this vengeance. As I have said, there was a vengeful side to me that I had in the past regretted. Regretted, but not expunged. I would not be telling the truth if I said I was not tempted.
Part 19. Study.
The Ardua Hall Holograph. Chapter 52. I had a disagreeable jolt last evening, my reader. I was scratching furtively away in the deserted library with my pen and my blue drawing ink, with my door open for airflow, when Aunt Fidala's head suddenly thrust itself around the corner of my private carrel. I did not startle. I have nerves of curable polymers, like those of plastinated corpses, but I coughed, a nervous reflex, and slid the closed Apologia Pro Vita Sua over the page I'd been writing on. "Ah, Aunt Lydia," said Aunt Fidala, "I hope you're not catching a cold. Shouldn't you be in bed?" "The big sleep," I thought, "that's what you're wishing for me." "Just an allergy," I said. "Many people have them at this time of year. She could not deny this, being a major sufferer herself. "I'm sorry for intruding," she said untruthfully. Her glance moved over Cardinal Newman's title. "Always researching, I see," she said. "Such a notorious heretic." "Know your enemy," I said. "How may I help you?" "I have something crucial to discuss. May I offer you a cup of warm milk at the Schlafly Café?" she said. "How kind," I replied. I replaced Cardinal Newman on my shelf, turning my back to her in order to slip my blue-inked page within. Soon the two of us were sitting at a café table, me with my warm milk, Aunt Fadala with her mint tea. "There was something odd about the Pearl Girls' Thanksgiving," she began. "And what was that? I thought it all went much as usual." "That new girl, Jade. I am not convinced by her," said Aunt Fadala. "She seems unlikely." "They all seem unlikely at first," I said. "But they want a safe haven, protected from poverty, exploitation, and the depredations of the so-called modern life. They want stability. They want order. They want clear guidelines. It will take her a little time to settle in." "Aunt Beatrice told me about that ridiculous tattoo on her arm. I suppose she told you as well." "Really? God and love, as if we could be taken in by such a crude attempt to curry favor. And such heretical theology. It reeks of an attempt to deceive. How do you know she's not a Mayday infiltrator?" "We've been successful in detecting those in the past," I said. "As for the bodily mutilation, the youth of Canada are pagans. They have all kinds of barbaric symbols branded on themselves. I believe it shows a good intention. At least it is not a dragonfly or a skull or some such item. But we will keep a close eye on her." "We should have that tattoo removed. It's blasphemous. The word God is holy. It does not belong on an arm." "Removal would be too painful for her at the moment. It can wait until later. We don't want to discourage our young supplicant. If she is a true one, which I very much doubt. It would be typical of Mayday to attempt a ruse of this kind. I think she should be interrogated." "By herself," was what she meant. "She does enjoy those interrogations a little too much." "The more haste, the less speed," I said. "I prefer more subtle methods." "You didn't prefer them in the early days," said Vidala. "You were all for the primary colors. You didn't used to mind a little blood." She sneezed. "Perhaps we should do something about the mildew in this café," I thought. Then again, perhaps not. It being late, I called Commander Judd in his office at home and requested a crash meeting, which was granted. I told my driver to wait for me outside. The door was opened by Judd's wife, Shunammite. She was not looking at all well. Thin, white-faced, hollow-eyed. She'd lasted a comparatively long time for a Judd wife, but at least she'd produced a baby, unbaby though it had been. Now, however, her time appeared to be running out. I wondered what Judd had been putting in her soup. "Oh, Aunt Lydia," she said, "please come in. The commander is expecting you." Why had she opened the door herself? Door opening is a Martha's job. She must have wanted something from me. I dropped my voice. "Shunammite, my dear," I smiled. "Are you ill?" She had once been such a lively young girl, if brash and aggravating, but she was now a sickly wraith. "I'm not supposed to say so," she whispered. "The commander tells me it's nothing. He says I invent complaints, but I know there's something wrong with me." "I can have our clinic at Ardua Hall do an evaluation," I said, "a few tests." "I would have to get his permission," she said. "He won't let me go." "I will obtain his permission for you," I said. "Never fear." There were tears then, and thank yous. In another age, she would have kneeled and kissed my hand. Judd was waiting in his study. I have been there before, sometimes when he was in it, sometimes when he was not. It is a richly informative space. He should not bring work home with him from his office at the Eyes and leave it lying around so carelessly. On the right wall, the one not visible from the door, as one must not shock the female inmates, there is a painting from the 19th century, showing a barely nubile girl without any clothes on. Dragonfly wings have been added to make her into a fairy, fairies having been known in those times to be averse to clothing. She has an amoral, elvish smile and is hovering over a mushroom. That's what Judd likes, young girls who can be viewed as not fully human, with a naughty core to them. That excuses his treatment of them. The study is book-lined, like all these commanders' studies. They like to accumulate and to gloat over their acquisitions and to boast to others about what they have pilfered. Judd has a respectable collection of biographies and histories. Napoleon, Stalin, Ceausescu, and various other leaders and controllers of men. He has several highly valuable editions that I envy. Doré's Inferno, Dali's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, Picasso's Lysistrata. He has another kind of book, less respectable. Vintage pornography, as I knew from having examined it. It is a genre that is tedious in bulk. The mistreatment of the human body has a limited repertoire. "Ah, Aunt Lydia," he said, half rising from his chair in an echo of what was once considered gentlemanly behavior. "Do sit down and tell me what brings you out so late." A beaming smile not reflected in the expression of his eyes, which was both alarmed and flinty. "We have a situation," I said, taking the chair opposite. His smile vanished. "Not a critical one, I hope." "Nothing that cannot be dealt with. Aunt Fadala suspects the so-called Jade of being an infiltrator, sent to ferret out information and put us in a bad light. She wishes to interrogate the girl. That would be fatal to any productive future use of baby Nicole." "I agree," he said. "We would not be able to televise her afterwards. What can I do to help you?" "To help us," I said. "It is always good to remind him that our little privateer holds two. An order from the Eyes protecting the girl from interference until we know she may be credibly presented as baby Nicole. Aunt Fadala is not aware of Jade's identity," I added, "and she should not be told. She is no longer fully reliable." "Can you explain that?" he said. "For the moment you'll have to trust me," I said. "And another thing. Your wife, Shunammite, ought to be sent to the Calm and Balm Clinic at Ardua Hall for medical treatment." There was a long pause while we gazed into each other's eyes across his desk. "Aunt Lydia, you read my mind," he said. "It would indeed be preferable for her to be in your care rather than in mine. In case anything might happen, in case she might develop a fatal illness. I will remind you here that there is no divorce in Gilead." "A sage decision," I said. "You must remain above suspicion." "I depend on your discretion. I am in your hands, dear Aunt Lydia," he said, rising from his desk. How true, I thought, and how easily a hand becomes a fist. My reader, I am now poised on the razor's edge. I have two choices. I can proceed with my risky and even reckless plan, attempt to transfer my packet of explosives by means of young Nicole, and if successful, give both Judd and Gilead the first shove over the cliff. If I am unsuccessful, I will naturally be branded a traitor and will live in infamy, or rather die in it. Or I could choose the safer course. I could hand baby Nicole over to Commander Judd, where she would shine brilliantly for a moment before being snuffed out like a candle due to insubordination, as the chances of her meekly accepting her position here would be zero. I would then reap my reward in Gilead, which would potentially be great. Aunt Vidala would be nullified. I might even have her assigned to a mental institution. My control over Ardua Hall would be complete, and my honored old age secure. I would have to give up the idea of retributive vengeance against Judd, as we would then be joined at the hip forever. Judd's wife, Shunammite, would be a collateral casualty. I have placed Jade in the same dormitory space as Aunt Immortelle and Aunt Victoria, so once she was eliminated, their own fates would hang in the balance. Guilt by association applies in Gilead, as it does elsewhere. Am I capable of such duplicity? Could I betray so completely? Having tunneled this far under the foundations of Gilead with my stash of cordite, might I falter? As I am human, it is entirely possible. In that case, I would destroy these pages I have written so laboriously, and I would destroy you along with them, my future reader. One flare of a match and you'll be gone, wiped away as if you had never been, as if you will never be. I would deny you existence. What a godlike feeling, though it is a god of annihilation. I waver, but tomorrow is another day.
Part 20. Bloodlines.
Transcript of Witness Testimony 369B. Chapter 53. I'd made it into Gilead. I'd thought I knew a lot about it, but living a thing is different. And with Gilead, it was very different. Gilead was slippery, like walking on ice. I felt off balance all the time. I couldn't read people's faces, and I often didn't know what they were saying. I could hear the words, I could understand the words themselves, but I couldn't translate them into meaning. At that first meeting in the chapel, after we'd done the kneeling and the singing, when Aunt Beatrice took me to a pew to sit down, I looked back over the room full of women. Everyone was staring at me and smiling in a way that was part friendly and part hungry, like those scenes in horror movies where you know the villagers will turn out to be vampires. Then there was an all-night vigil for the new pearls. We were supposed to be doing silent meditation while kneeling. Nobody had told me about this. What were the rules? Did you put up your hand to go to the bathroom? In case you're wondering, the answer was yes. After hours of this, my legs were really cramping. One of the new pearls, from Mexico, I think, began crying hysterically and then yelling. Two aunts picked her up and marched her out. I heard later that they'd turned her into a handmaid, so it was a good thing I'd kept my mouth shut. The following day, we were given those ugly brown outfits, and the next thing I knew, we were being herded off to a sports stadium, where we were seated in rows. No one had mentioned sports in Gilead. I'd thought they didn't have any. But it wasn't sports. It was a participation. They'd told us about those back in school, but they hadn't gone into too much detail, I guess, because they didn't want to traumatize us. Now I could understand that. It was a double execution. Two men, literally torn apart by a mob of frenzied women. There was screaming, there was kicking, there was biting, there was blood everywhere, on the handmaids especially. They were covered in it. Some of them held up parts, clumps of hair, what looked like a finger. And then the others yelled and cheered. It was gruesome. It was terrifying. It added a whole new dimension to my picture of handmaids. Maybe my mother had been like that, I thought. Feral.
Transcript of Witness Testimony 369A. Chapter 54. Becca and I did our best to instruct the new pearl, Jade, as Aunt Lydia had requested. but it was like talking to the air. She did not know how to sit patiently, with her back straight and her hands folded in her lap. She twisted, squirmed, fidgeted with her feet. "This is how women sit," Becca would tell her, demonstrating. "Yes, Aunt Immortelle," she would say, and she would make a show of trying. But these attempts did not last long, and soon she was slouching again and crossing her ankles over her knees. At Jade's first evening meal at Ardua Hall, we sat her between us for her own protection, because she was so heedless. Nonetheless, she behaved most unwisely. It was bread and an indeterminate soup. On Mondays, they often mixed up the leftovers and added some onions, and a salad of pea vines and white turnip. "The soup," she said. "It's like moldy dishwater. I'm not eating it." "Shh, be thankful for what you are given," I whispered back to her. "I'm sure it's nutritious." The dessert was tapioca, again. "I can't handle this." She dropped her spoon with a clatter. "Fish eyes in glue." "It's disrespectful not to finish," said Becca, "unless you're fasting." "You can have mine," said Jade. "People are looking," I said. When she'd first arrived, her hair was greenish. That was the sort of mutilation they went for in Canada, it seemed. But outside our apartment, she had to keep her hair covered, so this had not been generally noticed. Then she began pulling hairs out of the back of her neck. She said this helped her think. "You'll make a bald spot if you keep on doing that," Becca said to her. Aunt Este had taught us that when we were in the Ruby's premarital preparatory classes. If you remove hairs frequently, they will not grow back. It is the same with eyebrows and eyelashes. "I know," said Jade. "But nobody sees your hair around here anyway." She smiled at us confidingly. "One day, I'm going to shave my head."
"You can't do that. A woman's hair is her glory," said Becca. "It's been given to you as a covering. That's in Corinthians 1.
"Only one glory? Hair?" Jade said. Her tone was abrupt, but I don't think she meant to be rude.
"Why would you want to shame yourself by shaving your head?" I asked as gently as I could.
"If you were a woman, having no hair was a mark of disgrace. Sometimes, after a complaint by a husband, the aunts would cut off a disobedient or scolding econo-wife's hair before locking her into the public stocks." "To see what it's like to be bald," said Jade. "It's on my bucket list."
"You must be careful what you say to others," I told her.
"Becca, Aunt Immortelle and I are forgiving, and we understand that you are newly arrived from a degenerate culture. We are trying to help you. But other aunts, especially the older ones such as Aunt Fidala, are constantly on the lookout for faults."
"Yeah, you're right," said Jade. "I mean, yes, Aunt Victoria."
"What is a bucket list?" Becca asked.
"Stuff I want to do before I die."
"Why is it called that?"
"It's from Kick the Bucket," said Jade. "It's just a saying." Then, seeing our puzzled looks, she continued.
"I think it's from when they used to hang people from trees. They'd make them stand on a bucket and then hang them and their feet would kick. And naturally, they would kick the bucket.
Just my guess."
"That's not how we hang people here," said Becca.
Transcript of Witness Testimony 369B, Chapter 55. I quickly realized that the two young aunts in doorway C didn't approve of me, but they were all I had because I wasn't on talking terms with anyone else. Aunt Beatrice had been kind when she'd been converting me back in Toronto, but now that I was here, I was no longer any concern of hers. She smiled at me in a distant way when I passed her, but that was all. When I paused to think about it, I was afraid, but I tried not to let fear control me. I was also feeling very lonely. I didn't have any friends here, and I couldn't contact anyone back there. Ada and Elijah were far away. There was no one I could ask for guidance. I was on my own, with no instruction book. I really missed Garth. I daydreamed about the things we'd done together. Sleeping in the cemetery, panhandling on the street. I even missed the junk food we'd eaten. Would I ever get back there? And if I did, what would happen then? Garth probably had a girlfriend. How could he not have one? I'd never asked him because I didn't want to hear the answer. But one of my biggest anxieties was about the person Ada and Elijah called the Source, their contact inside Gilead. When would this person show up in my life? What if they didn't exist? If there was no Source, I'd be stuck here in Gilead, because there wouldn't be anyone to get me out.
Transcript of Witness Testimony 369A. Chapter 56. Jade was very untidy. She left her items in our common room, her stockings, the belt of her new supplicant's probationer uniform, sometimes even her shoes. She didn't always flush the toilet. We'd find her hair combings blowing around on the bathroom floor, her toothpaste in the sink. She took showers at unauthorized hours until firmly told not to, several times. I know these are trivial things, but they can add up in close quarters. There was also the matter of the tattoo on her left arm. It said God and love made into a cross. She claimed it was a token of her conversion to the true belief, but I doubted that, as she'd let slip on one occasion that she thought God was an imaginary friend. God is a real friend, not an imaginary one, said Becca. There was as much anger in her voice as she was capable of revealing. Sorry if I disrespected your cultural belief, Jade said, which did not improve things in the eyes of Becca. Saying God was a cultural belief was even worse than saying he was an imaginary friend. We realized that Jade thought we were stupid. Certainly, she thought we were superstitious. You should have that tattoo removed, Becca said. It's blasphemous. Yeah, maybe you're right, said Jade. I mean, yes, Aunt Immortelle, thank you for telling me. Anyway, it's itchy as hell. Hell is more than itchy, said Becca. I will pray for your redemption. When Jade was upstairs in her room, we would often hear thumping noises and muffled shouts. Was it a barbarian form of prayer? I finally had to ask her what she was doing in there. Working out, she said. It's like exercising. You have to keep strong. Men are strong in body, said Becca, and in mind. Women are strong in spirit. Though moderate exercise is allowed, such as walking, if a woman is of childbearing age. Why do you think you need to be strong in body? I asked her. I was becoming more and more curious about her pagan beliefs. In case some guy aggresses you. You need to know how to stick your thumbs in their eyes, knee them in the balls, throw a heart stopper punch. I can show you. Here's how to make a fist. Curl your fingers, wrap your thumb across your knuckles, keep your arm straight, aim for the heart. She slammed her fist into the sofa. Becca was so astonished that she had to sit down. Women don't hit men, she said.
or anyone, except when it's required by law, such as in participutions.
Well, that's convenient, said Jade. So you should just let them do whatever.
You shouldn't entice men, said Becca. What happens if you do is partly your fault.
Jade looked from one to the other of us. Victim blaming? She said. Really?
Pardon? Said Becca.
Never mind. So you're telling me it's a lose-lose? Jade said. We're screwed whatever we do. The two of us gazed at her in silence. No answer is an answer, as Aunt Lise used to say. Okay, she said. But I'm doing my workouts anyway. 4 days after Jade's arrival, Aunt Lydia called Becca and me to her office. How is the new Pearl getting along? She asked. When I hesitated, she said, Speak up.
She doesn't know how to behave, I said.
Aunt Lydia smiled her wrinkly old turnip smile. Remember, she has freshly come from Canada, she said. So she doesn't know any better. Foreign converts are often like that when they arrive. It is your duty, for the moment, to teach her safer ways.
We've been trying, Aunt Lydia, said Becca. But she's very...
Stubborn, said Aunt Lydia. I am not surprised. Time will cure it. Do the best you can. You may go.
We went out of the office in the sideways manner we all used when leaving Aunt Lydia's office. It was impolite to turn your back on her. The crime files continued to appear on my desk at the Hildegard Library. I could not decide what to think. One day, I felt it would be a blessed state to be a full aunt, knowing all the aunt's carefully hoarded secrets, wielding hidden powers, doling out retributions. The next day, I would consider my soul, because I did believe I had one, and how twisted and corrupted it would become if I were to act in that way. Was my soft, muddy brain hardening? Was I becoming stony, steely, pitiless? Was I exchanging my caring and pliable woman's nature for an imperfect copy of a sharp-edged and ruthless man's nature? I didn't want that, but how to avoid it if I aspired to be an aunt? Then something happened that changed my view of my position in the universe and caused me to give thanks anew for the workings of benign providence. Although I'd been granted access to the Bible and had been shown a number of dangerous crime files, I hadn't yet been given permission to access the Bloodline's genealogical archives, which were kept in a locked room. Those who'd been in there said this room contained aisles and aisles of folders. They were arranged on the shelves according to rank. Men only. Econo-men, guardians, angels, eyes, commanders. Within those categories, the bloodlines were filed by location, then by last name. The women were inside the folders of the men. The aunts didn't have folders. Their bloodlines weren't recorded because they wouldn't be having any children. That was a secret sadness for me. I liked children. I'd always wanted children. I just hadn't wanted what came with them. All supplicants were given a briefing about the archive's existence and purposes. They contained the knowledge of who the handmaids had been before they were handmaids, and who their children were, and who the fathers were. Not only the declared fathers, but the illegal fathers also, since there were many women, both wives and handmaids, who were desperate to have babies in any way they could. But in all cases, the aunts recorded the bloodlines. With so many older men marrying such young girls,
Gilead could not risk the dangerous and sinful father-daughter inbreeding that might result if no one was keeping track. But it was only after I'd done my Pearl Girls missionary work that I would have access to the archives. I'd longed for the moment when I'd be able to trace my own mother. Not Tabitha, but the mother who'd been a handmaid. In those secret files, I'd be able to find out who she was, or had been. Was she even still alive? I knew it was a risk. I might not like what I discovered, but I needed to try anyway. I might even be able to trace my real father, though that was less likely since he had not been a commander. If I could find my mother, I would have a story instead of a zero. I would have a past beyond my own past, though I would not necessarily have a future with this unknown mother inside it. One morning, I found a file from the archives on my desk. There was a small handwritten note paper-clipped to the front. Agnes Jemima's bloodline. I held my breath as I opened the file. Inside was the bloodline's record for Commander Kyle. Paula was in the folder, and their son, Mark. I wasn't part of that bloodline, so I wasn't listed as Mark's sister. But through Commander Kyle's line, I was able to discover the true name of poor Crystal, of Kyle, who'd died in childbirth, since little Mark was part of her bloodline, too. I wondered whether he would ever be told about her. Not if they could help it, was my guess. At last I found the bloodline on myself. It was not where it should have been, inside Commander Kyle's folder, in the time period relating to his first wife, Tabitha. Instead, it was at the back of the file in a subfile of its own. There was my mother's picture. It was a double picture, like the kind we'd see on wanted posters for runaway handmaids. The full face, the profile. She had light hair pulled back. She was young. She was staring right into my own eyes. What was she trying to tell me? She wasn't smiling. But why would she smile? Her picture must have been taken by the aunts, or else by the eyes. The name underneath had been blanked out using heavy blue ink. There was an updated notation, however. Mother of Agnes Jemima, now Aunt Victoria. Escaped to Canada. Currently working for Mayday Terrorist Intelligence. 2 elimination attempts made. Failed. Location currently unknown. Underneath that, it said biological father. But his name, too, had been redacted. There was no picture. The notation said, currently in Canada, said to be a Mayday operative, location unknown. Did I look like my mother? I wished to think so. Did I remember her? I tried to. I knew I should be able to, but the past was too dark. Such a cruel thing, memory. We can't remember what it is that we've forgotten, that we have been made to forget, that we've had to forget, in order to pretend to live here in any normal way. I'm sorry, I whispered. I can't bring you back. Not yet. I placed my hand on top of my mother's picture. Did it feel warm? I wanted that. I wanted to think that love and warmth were radiating out of this picture. Not a flattering picture, but that didn't matter. I wanted to think that this love was flowing into my hand. Childish make-believe. I know that. But it was comforting, nonetheless. I turned the page. there was another document. My mother had had a second child. That child had been smuggled into Canada as an infant. Her name was Nicole. There was a baby picture. Baby Nicole. Baby Nicole, whom we prayed for on every solemn occasion at Ardua Hall. Baby Nicole, whose sunny, cherubic face appeared on Gilead television so often as a symbol of the unfairness being shown to Gilead on the international stage. Baby Nicole, who was practically a saint and martyr, and was certainly an icon. That baby Nicole was my sister. Underneath the last paragraph of text, there was a line of wavery handwriting in blue ink. Top secret. Baby Nicole is here in Gilead. It seemed impossible. I felt a rush of gratitude. I had a younger sister. But I also felt frightened. If baby Nicole was here in Gilead, why hadn't everyone been told? There would have been widespread rejoicing and a huge celebration. Why had I myself been told? I felt entangled, though the nets around me were invisible. Was my sister in danger? Who else knew she was here, and what would they do to her? By this time, I knew that the person leaving these files for me must be Aunt Lydia. But why was she doing it? And how did she want me to react? My mother was alive, but she was also under sentence of death. She'd been deemed a criminal, worse, a terrorist. How much of her was in me? Was I tainted in some way? Was that the message? Gilead had tried to kill my renegade mother and had failed. Should I be glad about this, or sorry? Where should my loyalties lie? Then, on impulse, I did a very dangerous thing. Making sure no one was watching, I slipped the two pages with their glued-on pictures out of the Bloodlines file, then folded them several times and hid them in my sleeve. Somehow I could not bear to be parted with them. It was foolish and headstrong, but it was not the only foolish and headstrong thing I have ever done.
Transcript of Witness Testimony 369B Chapter 57. It was a Wednesday, the woe day. After the usual putrid breakfast, I received a message to go immediately to Aunt Lydia's office. What does it mean? I asked Aunt Victoria. Nobody ever knows what Aunt Lydia might have in mind, she said. Have I done something bad? There was a big choice of bad things, that was for sure. Not necessarily, she said. You might have done something good. Aunt Lydia was waiting for me in her office. The door was ajar, and she told me to come in even before I'd knocked. Close the door behind you and sit down, she said. I sat down. She looked at me. I looked at her. It's strange because I knew she was supposed to be the powerful, mean old queen bee of Ardua Hall. But right then, I didn't find her scary. She had a big mole on her chin. I tried not to stare at it. I wondered why she hadn't had it taken off. How are you enjoying it here, Jade? She said. Are you adjusting? I should have said yes or fine or something, the way I'd been trained. Instead, I blurted, not well. She smiled, showing her yellowy teeth. Many have regrets at first, she said. Would you like to go back? Like how? I said. Flying monkeys? I suggest you refrain from making that kind of flippant remark in public. It could have painful repercussions for you. Do you have something to show me? I was puzzled. Like what? I asked. No, I didn't bring... On your arm, for instance. Under your sleeve. Oh, I said. My arm. I rolled up the sleeve. There was my God love tattoo, not looking very pretty. She peered at it. Thank you for doing as I requested, she said. She was the one who'd requested it? Are you the source? I asked. The what? Was I in trouble? You know, the one... I mean... She cut me off. You must learn to edit your thoughts, she said. Unthink them. Now, next steps. You are baby Nicole, as you must have been told in Canada. Yeah, but I'd rather not be, I said. I'm not happy about it. I'm sure that is true, she said. But many of us would rather not be who we are. We don't have unlimited choices in that department. Now, are you ready to help your friends back in Canada? What do I have to do? I asked. Come over here and place your arm on the desk, she said. This won't hurt. She took a thin blade and made a nick in my tattoo, at the base of the O. Then, using a magnifying glass and a minute pair of tweezers, she slid something very small into my arm. She was wrong about it not hurting. No one would think of looking inside God. Now you're a carrier pigeon, and all we have to do is transport you. It's harder than it would have been once, but we'll manage it. Oh, and don't tell anyone about this until granted permission. Loose lips sink ships, and sinking ships kill people. Yes? Yes, I said. Now I had a lethal weapon in my arm. Yes, Aunt Lydia. Don't slip up on manners here, ever. You could trigger a denunciation, even for something so minor. Aunt Vidala loves her corrections.
Transcript of Witness Testimony 369A. Chapter 58. Two mornings after I'd read my bloodlines file, I received a summons to Aunt Lydia's office. Becca had also been ordered to attend. We walked over together. We thought we were going to be asked again how Jade was getting along, whether she was happy with us, whether she was ready for her literacy test, whether she was firm in her faith. Becca said she was going to request that Jade be moved elsewhere, because we'd been unable to teach her anything. She simply didn't listen. But Jade was already in Aunt Lydia's office when we got there, sitting on a chair. She smiled at us, an apprehensive smile. Aunt Lydia let us in, then looked up and down the corridor before closing the door. Thank you for coming, she said to us. You may sit down. We sat in the two chairs provided, one on either side of Jade. Aunt Lydia herself sat down, placing her hands on her desk to lower herself. Her hands were slightly tremulous. I found myself thinking, she's getting old. But that did not seem possible. Surely Aunt Lydia was ageless. I have some information to share with you that will materially affect the future of Gilead, Aunt Lydia said. You yourselves will have a crucial part to play. Are you brave enough? Do you stand ready? Yes, Aunt Lydia, I said, and Becca repeated the same words. The younger supplicants were always being told they had a crucial part to play and that bravery was required of them. Usually it meant giving up something, like time or food. Good. I will be brief. First, I must inform you, Aunt Immortelle, of something that the other two already know. Baby Nicole is here in Gilead. I was confused. Why would the girl Jade have been told such an important piece of news? She could have no idea of what an impact the appearance of such an iconic figure would have among us.
Really? Oh, praise be, Aunt Lydia, said Becca. That is such wonderful news. Here, in Gilead? But why have we not all been told? It's like a miracle.
Control yourself, please, Aunt Immortelle. I must now add that baby Nicole is the half-sister of Aunt Victoria.
No shit!
Jade exclaimed.
I don't believe this!
Jade, I did not hear that, said Aunt Lydia. Self-reverence, self-knowledge, self-control. Sorry, Jade mumbled.
Agnes, I mean, Aunt Victoria, Becca said. You have a sister. That is so joyful. And it's baby Nicole. You are so lucky. Baby Nicole is so adorable.
There was the standard picture of baby Nicole on Aunt Lydia's wall. She was indeed adorable. But then, all babies are adorable.
May I hug you?
Becca said to me. She was fighting hard to be positive. It must have been sad for her that I had a known relative, but she did not have any. Even her pretend father had just been shamefully executed. Calm, please, said Aunt Lydia. Time has passed since baby Nicole was a baby. She is now grown up.
Of course, Aunt Lydia, said Becca.
She sat down, folded her hands in her lap. But if she is here in Gilead, Aunt Lydia, I said, where is she exactly? Jade laughed. It was more like a bark.
She is at Ardua Hall, said Aunt Lydia, smiling.
It was like a guessing game. She was enjoying herself. We must have looked mystified. We knew everyone at Ardua Hall. So where was baby Nicole?
She is in this room, Aunt Lydia announced. She waved a hand. Jade here is baby Nicole.
It can't be, I said.
Jade was baby Nicole? Therefore Jade was my sister? Becca sat with her mouth open, staring at Jade.
No,
she whispered. Her face was woeful.
Sorry about not being adorable, Jade said. I tried, but I'm terrible at it. I believe she meant it as a joke, to lighten the atmosphere.
Oh, I didn't mean, I said. It's just,
you don't look like baby Nicole.
No, she does not, said Aunt Lydia. But she does look like you.
It was true up to a point. The eyes, yes, but not the nose. I glanced down at Jade's hands, folded for once in her lap. I wanted to ask her to stretch out her fingers so I could compare them to mine, but I felt that might be offensive. I didn't wish her to think I was demanding too much evidence of her genuineness, or else rejecting her.
I'm very happy to have a sister, I said to her politely, now that I was overcoming the shock.
This awkward girl shared a mother with me. I'd have to try my best.
You're both so lucky, said Becca. Her voice was wistful.
And you're like my sister, I told her. So Jade is like your sister, too. I didn't want Becca to feel left out.
May I hug you?
Becca said to Jade. Or, as I suppose I should now call her in this account, Nicole.
Yeah, I guess,
said Nicole. She then received a little hug from Becca. I followed suit.
Thanks,
she said. Thank you, Aunts Immortelle and Victoria, said Aunt Lydia. You are demonstrating an admirable spirit of acceptance and inclusion. Now, I must trouble you for your full attention. We turned our faces towards her. Nicole will not be with us for long, said Aunt Lydia. She will be leaving Ardua Hall shortly and traveling back to Canada. She will be taking an important message with her. I want you both to help her. I was astonished. Why was Aunt Lydia letting her go back? No convert ever went back. It was treason. And if that person was baby Nicole, it was treason 10 times over. But Aunt Lydia, I said, that is against the law, and also God's will as proclaimed by the commanders.
Indeed, Aunt Victoria. But as you and Aunt Immortelle have now read a good many of the secret files I've been placing in your way, are you not aware of the deplorable degree of corruption that currently exists in Gilead?
Yes, Aunt Lydia, but surely... I had not been certain that Becca, too, had been treated to the crime files. Both of us had obeyed the top secret classification, but more importantly, each of us had wished to spare the other.
The aims of Gilead at the outset were pure and noble, we all agree, she said. But they have been subverted and sullied by the selfish and the power mad, as so often happens in the course of history. You must wish to see that set right.
Yes, said Becca, nodding. We do wish it.
Remember, too, your vows. You pledged yourselves to help women and girls. I trust you meant that.
Yes, Aunt Lydia, I said. We did.
This will be helping them. Now, I don't want to force you to do anything against your will, but I must state the position clearly. Now that I have told you this secret, that baby Nicole is here, and that she will soon be acting as a courier for me, every minute that passes in which you do not divulge this secret to the eyes will count as treachery. But even if you do divulge it, you may still be severely punished, perhaps even terminated for having held back, even for an instant. Needless to say, I myself will be executed, and Nicole will soon be no better than a caged parrot. If she won't comply, they'll kill her, one way or another. They won't hesitate. You've read the crime files.
You can't do that to them, Nicole said. That's not fair. It's emotional blackmail.
I appreciate your views, Nicole, said Aunt Lydia. But your juvenile notions of fairness do not apply here. Keep your sentiments to yourself, and if you wish to see Canada again, it would be wise to consider that a command.
She turned to the two of us.
You are, of course, free to make your own decisions. I will leave the room. Nicole, come with me. We wish to give your sister and her friend a little privacy in which to consider the possibilities. We will return in 5 minutes. At that time, I shall simply require a yes or a no from you. Other details regarding your mission will be supplied in good time. Come, Nicole.
She took Nicole by the arm and steered her out of the room. Becca's eyes were wide and frightened, as mine must have been. We have to do it, Becca said. We can't let them die. Nicole is your sister. And Aunt Lydia. Do what? I said. We don't know what she's asking for. She's asking for obedience and loyalty, said Becca. Remember how she rescued us
both of us? We have to say yes.
After leaving Aunt Lydia's office, Becca went to the library for her day shift, and Nicole and I walked back to our apartment together.
Now that we're sisters, I said, you can call me Agnes when we're alone.
Okay, I'll try, Nicole said.
We went into the main room.
I have something I want to share with you, I said. Just a minute.
I went upstairs. I'd been keeping the two pages from the Bloodlines files under my mattress, folded up small. When I returned, I unfolded them carefully and flattened them out. Once I'd laid them out on the table, Nicole, like me, couldn't resist placing her hand on the picture of our mother.
This is amazing, she said.
She took her hand off, studied the picture again.
Do you think she looks like me?
I wondered the same thing, I said. Can you remember her at all? I must have been too young.
I don't know, I said. Sometimes I think I can. I do seem to remember something. Was there a different house? Did I travel somewhere? But maybe it's wishful thinking.
What about our fathers? She said. And why did they blink?